Good afternoon. It is 6 minutes after 12, and this is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences. Ahead this hour, remember impeachment? A crazy 2019 news cycle is giving way to what seems to be a crazier 2020 news cycle. Last month, for just the third time in history, an American president was impeached by the U.S. House, but what's next? John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, says he's quite uncertain about what's next. His first conversation of 2020 with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics ahead on this Ozarks at Large. And after our show on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR, anger in Iran after the U.S. kills an Iranian military leader, plus the latest on the Australian wildfires. The news you need to know about on Here and Now beginning right after Ozarks at Large. The next Books and Brews meetup is approaching, and we're giving you about 18 hours' notice to read Carson McCullough's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. The novel will be discussed at tomorrow's meeting at Apple Blossom Brewing Company in Fayetteville. The event, sponsored by the Fayetteville Public Library, it begins at 6 tomorrow evening. Each month's selected book is available at the library's checkout desk in the lobby. This is Ozarks at Large. The Rogers Historical Museum, which underwent a renovation and expansion a year ago, has a new director. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek tells us more about the recent hire's vision and plans for the museum at its new location.
About this time last year, the Rogers Historical Museum was celebrating its move into a new building.
Every staff member here has done anything and everything to get items across the street, items in place, dust bunnies chased, you name it, they've worked on it.
Now the museum is going into 2020 with a new director. Her name is Serena Barnett, and she took on the role just before the holidays.
The small museums really help tell the story of where we came from locally. You know, you have the big museums, the Smithsonians of the world, who tell the larger stories of our nation. So we tell a story that if we're not going to tell it, no one else is.
Former director John Burroughs resigned a year ago after guiding the museum through its transition from the Keewing building to the much larger Haley building across the street. The new facility had once belonged to the Morning News. Before that, it was a Ford dealership. Here's Burroughs during a tour he gave us back in late 2018, just before the grand opening.
Newt Haley, who came to Rogers in the 1930s, purchased a Ford dealership. He originally ran a dealership on First Street right behind this building. After the Second World War, he constructed this building to be his main auto dealership. The storefront on First Street became a tractor dealership for Ford tractors.
For Barnett, becoming the museum's newest director is a bit of a homecoming. It's where she began her career in 2002.
I was hired as a museum education assistant, and so I did children's programming. And I left in 2008 to pursue my history degree at the University of Arkansas and then went on to Johns Hopkins University and got my master's in museum studies.
Between now and then, Barnett worked at Peerage National Military Park and the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa.
And then when the job for the director came up this last year, I decided to go for it. This is my dream job. I honestly love this museum so much. My heart is here. This was the very first museum my family brought me to as a young child. This was my first museum field trip in school. And this is my very first museum job.
And while she fell in love with the old museum, Barnett says it didn't have enough room to tell the whole story of the city of Rogers.
Here in the Haley Building, we actually start with the early history of Rogers, kind of gives a timeline through the beginnings all through modern day. And then it moves on to different segments, like we discuss Montanay, we discuss the Beaver Lake and how it came about to become a lake from damming the White River. And we also talk about, even things like the weather. What's the weather like in this area and historically how it's changed?
Barnett says she wants to expand on that with temporary exhibits that tell stories the museum hasn't told before.
We're learning new stories all the time. People donate new things, new objects, and every object has a different story. So we're learning new things all the time, and we want to be able to share that with our community.
The first exhibit of the new year, called To Do the Laundry, will open later this month on January 18th.
And it discusses the old Victorian ways of doing the washing. You do your washing on Mondays, and then you would iron on Tuesdays. And it covers the history of that.
Barnett says later in the year, visitors can expect an exhibit about Arkansas's influential women. The museum is also launching a kids' craft corner that will take place every third Saturday of every month.
And every month will be a different theme. This month for January, we have Make a Mini Mandolin. And so your kids, they'll come and they'll get a mini history lesson and do a little craft with every session.
Barnett says her plans also include hosting more events and collaborating with other downtown businesses and organizations.
The more we work together, the more we have to offer the community. So that's my goal, is to start reaching out to those organizations and businesses and see what we can all do to work together.
And Barnett says she wants to take advantage of the flurry of activity downtown, including the construction of the new Frisco Park, which is just two blocks from the museum.
We're just right in the middle of it, and we want to be involved with all the activity that's going on downtown. I'm really excited that it's coming back around and growing, and this is where people want to be now. I love that, and I look forward to having more buzz around the museum because of all of the growth going on.
Even though Barnett is making plans for the future, she says her favorite part of the museum is one of its staples. The Hawkins House was originally built in 1895 and was home to three generations of the Hawkins family until 1979.
I love that building. That is where I remember my first tour was through that house. And I'd like to think of it as a time capsule. We have it set up as if the family was still living there. The furniture's in place. There's no ropes cording off the rooms. You are literally walking through this family's home.
Barnett encourages anyone who may not have found history particularly interesting in school to give it another go.
We are not your little small cobweb infested, you know, history museum like you kind of think of stereotypically. We are really trying to be cutting edge in what we have to offer, the way we offer our history and tell the stories of our community.
And for Barnett, the museum is what brings Rogers' past, present, and future together under one roof.
Even if you have only lived here a year or 6 months, or if you've lived here your entire life, you are still a part of this community, and therefore you are connected to those people that began our community.
The museum is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and admission is free. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Susanna Sitek.
And still to come on this edition of Ozarks at Large, our militant grammarian is back for the first time in the new year. She says she hopes the year goes well, and we do good. The differences between well and good ahead on the show in about 30 minutes.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
The one constant in 2020 politics, as early as this year, seems to be uncertainty. The previous year ended with an impeachment of the President of the United States House, but those articles of impeachment have yet to be delivered to the Senate, and we're unsure just what's next. And the shrinking, but still large, Democratic field of challengers to the President still presents far more questions than answers as well. Wading into this unpredictability today are John Brummett, political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. Roby asked if there is any way to figure out what's next in the impeachment process.
Can you even read a crystal ball? Are they going to have a trial without getting the articles of impeachment? Are they going to broker some deal at the last minute and Schumer and McConnell and Pelosi say, here's
no,
what we're going
to do? No, I can't. My instinct, which I don't necessarily trust in this matter because I've been surprised by this all along, but my instinct is that status quo kind of works for everybody. Democrats don't have to lose their impeachment. They can let the impeachment hover. which would be sort of like they merely censured him, which is what I wanted them to do in the first place. The Senate doesn't have to have a trial it doesn't want to have. And Trump has the talking point that this was just a witch hunt and they wouldn't even send it over. And Pelosi has the talking point, I won't send it because they prematurely acquitted him. And that's not, and everybody has something to talk about as we go forth into the election year. Mm-hmm. That seems to work for everybody because I think this whole impeachment thing.
Maybe all the players, I don't know if it works for the general public that are like, can we resolve some of this?
The general public doesn't give a darn. I don't find anybody outside the partisan players who think this amounted to anything or that it was done properly, really. By anybody. So for those purposes, I find the status quo okay. The usual horse fly in the ointment, by that I mean a big fly in the ointment, is Trump, who apparently wants a chaotic trial and acquittal, but all of which he thinks works to his benefit by making the Democrats look trivial. I think that's what he thinks. He wants to be declared, essentially, not guilty. So we'll see. I don't know what the crystal ball is. I know if I were in charge of it, what I would do, everybody hold your, stay in place where you are, talk your talking points, and let's get on with this presidential race because that's what it's going to come down to anyway.
Well, let's turn to the presidential race.
Right.
The Democrats
we'll
have
some
a busy...
smooth segues today.
We have a busy Democratic presidential primary. We've seen some polling over the last couple of days, couple of weeks, that show there is some separation, I guess, between Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Pete Buttigieg, maybe Amy Klobuchar sneaking up there.
And yeah, a little bit.
A little bit. Michael Bloomberg, a little bit. They're showing some...
Bloomberg positive. Shows exceptional strength not to be in the race. I mean, but he's just there in case everybody wrecks in the middle of the... and ties up the interstate for a while.
So it's possible that the potential Democratic presidential nominee, eventual nominee, could finish in fourth place in New Hampshire.
This is a strange situation. Right now, the best assessment of the race is that the person whose eventual track to the nomination seems clearest is Joe Biden. African-American support, senior Democrat supports, older Democrats who are a big part of voting primaries, but not Iowa and New Hampshire, where there's scant African-American vote, and where there tends to be the Democrats that are in those states tend to be independent-minded, liberal-minded white Democrats. It is entirely possible, if the current polls were to hold, and this is all close, mm-hmm. you got people close, Joe Biden could finish fourth in both Iowa and New Hampshire. Fourth in both. Remember, in years past, Iowa's been like a big deal. Obama wins. Obama's on his way. Howard Dean loses. Howard Dean is out. You know, it's been a big identifier. Biden could be fourth, and he could go to New Hampshire and be fourth. Buttigieg could win both. He could win Iowa, more likely, and Bernie Sanders. Don't forget Bernie Sanders. He's not going away. Mm-hmm. Could win New Hampshire. Then they go to the Nevada caucuses on a Saturday after that. And nobody ever pays much attention, but Sanders has caucus strength. He beat Hillary Clinton in a lot of caucuses.
We got to
go all the way to South Carolina, where Joe Shirley's going to win with about 40 or 40-plus percent because of the African-American vote and older Democrats. Then you go to Super Tuesday, where Biden might be expected to do well because of his name ID and his national support, but where all of a sudden Bloomberg will say, I'm really running, this is serious business. None of these guys can't beat each other, much less Trump. Mm-hmm.
See some people drop out after Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and you maybe see some voters go to some of the other people that have been winning.
And I did some calculations over the weekend, and the more center-left, pragmatic, beat Trump block is bigger than the populist left Medicare for All block. I mean, Biden, Buttigieg, Bloomberg, Klobuchar together are about 44%, whereas Sanders and Warren are about 34%. So I think there's going to be, if it comes down to that, I think there are more Democrats who'll say, I'm going to go with Biden because I want to beat Trump and he looks like he's the one who can do it. But it could be one of the strangest election seasons, and we don't have any superdelegates to work all this out.
Unless it goes to a convention and there's not somebody with enough delegates to win at the convention, and then the superdelegates.
Now, there is some...
But we're getting way ahead of it.
There's worry right now among Democratic establishment that Bernie, wait a minute, if Bernie should win Iowa, finish second to Buttigieg, then wins New Hampshire, then wins the Nevada caucuses, and is raising more money than we can conventionally raise by all these actual human beings who are for him and sending him money, Sanders. I mean, the two paths to victory you can see are Biden and Sanders. Buttigieg, I just don't think so in the end. I think he's too young, and Elizabeth Warren seems to be stymied. So, yeah, it's probably Biden, but you can't exactly see how it happens.
Right.
And so that's where it is.
John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and his columns can be found in the physical newspaper in Northwest Arkansas, in the Arkansas River Valley, and everywhere at ArkansasOnline.com. He talked with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. You can find more from the conversation at TalkBusiness.net. This is Ozarks at Large. Winter days are shorter and colder. These conditions, mixed with a desire to cocoon at home after a busy holiday season, can mean we don't see each other as much. For some people, winter may be the loneliest time of year. For others, it could be the continuation of just being lonely. We continue our series of conversations about aging and health, coordinated with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, with a conversation about loneliness. John Eichler is an assistant professor in the Occupational Therapy doctoral program at the University of Arkansas and University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. She came to the Carver Center for Public Radio recently to discuss ways to avoid loneliness, the importance of friendship, and even offer us a sound resolution for the new year. She says loneliness can affect people of all ages.
Most of the time when I've talked about loneliness, it's been with the clients who I work with. And it's usually couched around a comment that they would make about their friends dying or their spouse dying or not having any more friends their age because there are no more left. And it's usually something that people don't really think about the impacts on. And so that's what I wanted to talk about today.
I want to get to friendship in just a little bit, but let's talk about this season. Is winter, I mean, there's shorter days, and I think some of us can be, you know, affected by this. Is winter a tougher time for loneliness than other seasons?
Well, for most people, especially in areas where weather gets really cold, people tend to go inside of their houses more in the wintertime. Days are shorter, and people will kind of hole up and get in front of the fireplace and not really, you know, talk to people in the neighborhood. People don't go out their front doors. They'll come in their garages and they emerge in the springtime. And so there is a chance that people will experience more loneliness in the wintertime because people just they don't want to get outside at night in the cold.
So I think most of us can get to the conclusion that being lonely can be not favorable for mental health. But what about personal safety in the home? Can that also be a factor here?
Well, if you think about the predominant reason why people who are elderly are in danger in their home, it's usually because they might have a fall. And if they live alone and they have a fall, there are many instances where people have been left on the floor or in the tub or in a place where they have no access to communication devices. And some people have died because of that, because nobody comes to check on them. And if we do pair that with the fact that people in the wintertime don't go out very often and wouldn't necessarily make that spontaneous visit very often, there's a higher chance, we can deduce that there would be a higher chance that a person might not be found because nobody would be thinking of them or coming to their house.
You mentioned the word friendships. You've thought a lot about friendships, haven't you?
I have worked a lot with people on friendships. I've done programs for people who have autism, and that's a great population to be thinking about friendships. As people age and they start talking about their friendships with me as we're working on whatever it is that they're working on and their goals, it has really started to make me think about how friendship goes across the lifespan. I even talk to my students about it in wellness.
What are those conversations like? I'm just curious. Because it's weird. Friendship is also something it seems like we don't specifically outwardly talk about a lot. as human beings.
No, we really don't. But there's a lot of discussion around people who like to talk about friendships.
Right.
If you did a search on Google and you looked up friendships, you would find a list of the 10 kinds of friends you need, the 4 kinds of friends you need, the 7 kinds of friends you need. There's actually some research around the types of friends that everyone needs. And it's interesting to delve into that, because when we start to reflect on who we talk to about things, or who we ask people, who we ask when we need something, who we confide in, who we love to go on adventures with, it's often not the same person. And their characteristics around certain people, and we look for those. We tend to naturally look for those. And when we feel fulfilled with our friendships, it's usually because we have the full complement of whatever we need.
Are there certain kinds of friends you agree with that we do need, this recipe of friendship?
Well, there are a lot of different opinions on this, but there's some commonalities. Most people need a best friend, or somebody who they can confide in, somebody who's really close. Sometimes that's a spouse, and sometimes that's somebody outside of a marriage. Or maybe it's a couple of best friends for different things. But that's the kind of person who you can talk to about anything, and they'll always love you. They might be able to tell you the truth about something, and you won't take it badly from that person, because you know that they love you and you know that they have your best interests. Having somebody to adventure with is important. And adventuring can mean different things to different people. Some people, the adventuring might be just going for a walk in the neighborhood. And for other people, it might be going on a really great cruise or a road trip or a bucket list item, you know, check off. Or maybe it's the person who you adventure with to go to musicals or plays or out to places, restaurants, things like that. Adventuring can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. And exploring new places is a way to keep our minds fresh and to enjoy our community and not to get too bored, because boredom can lead to mental health issues. And we don't really want that to happen at any point in our life.
We know, we understand the value of friendship, but understanding the value of friendship doesn't always mean you have friends. I mean, there's a common conversation, I think, among people as they move from college into the professional world. Like, it's tougher now to find friends, especially if you move to a new city or something. So finding friends, easier said than done sometimes.
It really is. You know, we'll normally find friends in the places where we go. Mm-hmm. If we're not really apt to go exploring, we may have a harder time finding friends in those places. So people who join things or have specific things that they like to seek out, like a public speaking club or an outdoors group or even a social club or a philanthropy club, you know, places like that have built-in people who have things in common with us who we might naturally gravitate toward and become friends with. That's what school does. School is that commonality. And that's where we make all of our friends and where we learn how to make our friends as we grow up. As we get older, though, and we get less mobile and less social and lose the people who we do those activities with, there's a higher chance that we lose that social contact.
Is it important to have friends that are different than you?
Oh, it's so important. And if we think about where we get our friendship skills, it usually can be traced back into our earlier years. And well-meaning parents will have their children doing activities with people who are familiar. It's a lot easier in a busy life to not bring anything complicated into that arena. And so in another area of my practice, you know, that could be the child in a wheelchair who doesn't get invited to people's houses because their houses aren't accessible. It's not easy for a play date to happen for the other parent. And so they just don't know what to do. They're more comfortable with that friend who's very familiar. The other thing that happens is, let's say in kindergarten, there's a child who's being bullied in the classroom for some reason, and there's a nice kid. And that nice kid gets asked by the teacher, by the parent of that bullied child, you know, your child's really nice. You know, Mary's a really nice girl. Billy's having a hard time. Would you tell Mary to please be nice to Billy? And then maybe that will help Billy. And Mary's nice to Billy. She's very happy to do that. She's incredibly nice to Billy, but she doesn't invite Billy to her birthday party because she doesn't know how to be friends with Billy. And that's something that we don't teach. We don't really recognize the difference between being nice and being friends. And friendship is a much deeper, much more meaningful relationship than a person who's nice.
Can we consciously, no matter our age, think about how to become a friend? Is that an exercise we can consciously develop?
I believe we can. I think we should be working on things like that, especially as things get more difficult for all of us. And, you know, we know as we age that we're going to have less access to people who have commonalities with us, especially peers. As we get older, interesting peers who share our desires and the kinds of things that we like to do are not necessarily going to be prevalent in our environment. It's going to be younger people. Younger people are different. Mm-hmm. If you think about the differences between somebody in their 80s and somebody in their 30s, we're talking completely different ways of communicating. And so it is a learned thing. And it's not a hard thing to do, but it does require some thought, and it can be really fun.
And the exposure, I suppose, to potential friends can be limited if, as a person ages, perhaps mobility is an issue or don't want to drive at night or things like that. So the circles of potential friends can shrink.
They really can. I think about my grandmother and she died at 96. She lived alone it was the best case scenario. She was out in the country, lived by herself, was independent, and had a lot of children. And so people would come in and out of the house a lot, but they didn't live in the area. So they had to travel and they would spend the night. She was a lot of fun to be around, very active, continued driving. And one of the things that happened on her 90th birthday when she hit 90, we said, well, what are you going to do? Her name was Bird. I said, what are you going to do now? And she goes, well, I haven't painted yet. And so she took up painting. And what was fun about that was that she started hosting art lessons in her house, where people would come to her house and they would have lunch or something and they would do art lessons. She also did bridge that way, where they would go to people's houses for bridge. And they had a really good time doing that. And sometimes it was hosted at somebody else's house. And the thing that I get a kick out of is that my grandmother was responsible for picking a woman who was 63 years old and couldn't drive up for the art class. So it can go in a lot of different directions. We can't really label people who are aging as not being able to do things.
Absolutely right.
But we should be aware that there are some age-related changes that occur that make it more difficult, like driving at night. You know, nighttime activities can be more difficult, not because they can't stay up. I know my share of older people who love to stay up really late. They might be the last one to go to bed at a party, but they just can't drive. And so that can really inhibit whether or not people can get around.
Intergenerational friendship's important for everybody?
Absolutely. One of the types of friendships that shows up on many of the lists that I was reviewing is a wise mentor. And we think a wise mentor is somebody who's older than we are. But a wise mentor could be younger. And if we start to recognize that, maybe that younger person could teach the older person something and help them to regroup and become a part of society, especially if most of their friends are decompensating or maybe going off to nursing homes or maybe they've died or maybe they've lost a spouse. And they need to learn to live in the world again because they may have to just start over in some aspects. Hard to do when you're in your 80s and 90s. Could be a lot of fun and very energizing if somebody in their 40s or 30s takes interest and starts being inclusive. I think it's good for everybody.
During much of this conversation, I think we've been thinking about face-to-face, maybe physical sorts of friendships. Can social media help with friendships?
I've seen it happen.
Okay.
I've seen it happen with people who feel really disconnected, who aren't aging, people who are maybe home with a child who has special needs or caregiving for a spouse. Support networks on social media are so valuable. I sit on a lot of those, and I really learn a lot from people who are talking about what it's like and how taxing it is. I'm inspired by that to really talk to my students about it and to address when I'm working with caregivers and clients, to address those issues with them and to ask the question, how are you doing? How's your back? You know, you're not supposed to be lifting at your age, but it looks like you're having to help a lot more. How's that going for you? Can I help you? Can I find you some equipment? Do you need some respite? And just thinking about that or seeing that if we're on the outside, if our neighbor looks like they might be needing some help. I've had neighbors who have reached out to me before because I've offered and you know, said, can you just come over and see if this grab bar looks right? Or, you know, we can't get this person off the floor.
And a grab bar is something you use to lift yourself.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so those are adaptations that we might put into a home to make them universally accessible. There are other things that might happen. I had a neighbor in St. Louis who fell on her front porch, and it doesn't take an occupational therapy degree to go and help her up. It takes attentiveness and willingness to notice. That's important. You know, we don't look beyond our lives very often, especially in the wintertime. And it's important to pay attention to what's going on around us, especially with people who are vulnerable.
It's the time of year when, for whatever reason, we like to make resolutions, right? We have this demarcation, 2020. If we were going to, the royal we wanted to make some resolutions about loneliness or friendship for us and for the people around us to make this a less lonely world that we live in. Got any ideas what a resolution or two could be?
Actually, I do.
Oh, good.
Since I was little, I've seen a really big change in the way that we know our next-door neighbor. What if we made this the year of the neighbor and we decided that we were going to get to know the people who live next door to us on either side? No matter how old they are, what they have in common.
Or what political yard sign they have in that yard.
Yeah, like all of that, you know, just sort of delve into it and get to know them. And if you don't know how to do that, if you didn't grow up with that kind of lifestyle where you could just go in and visit because the door was always open, or stop in and it was dinner time and you get invited. If you didn't grow up in that time, this is how you do it. You bake some cookies and you go over and you say, I thought you might enjoy these. Or you offer to help mow the lawn if it's like somebody who's older, or you shovel their snow out of their driveway just to be nice, and they'll invite you in for hot chocolate or something, and then you've stirred up a friendship. There are a lot of different ways to do it, and if we knew our neighbors better, we would probably be a more compassionate and understanding world overall.
John Eichler is an assistant professor in the Occupational Therapy Doctoral Program at the University of Arkansas and University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Our conversation took place in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio and continues our series of conversations about health and aging. Up next, a conversation that will be about alcohol and aging. That's next month on Ozarks at Large. Later this week, guitarist Jesse Cook and his band will perform at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. The classical flamenco and world music guitarist touches on a wide range of styles on his instrument. Last month, Timothy Dennis reached Cook via phone from his home in Canada to talk about the upcoming performance in Fayetteville, which is part of a broader tour throughout the South and southeastern U.S. Among other things, Timothy asked Cook whether there was any one style of world music that particularly influences his music.
I think because, you know, as a guitarist, my voice in it has that sort of Spanish guitar sound. Mm-hmm. I will often lean on the Moorish influence, you know, that the Moors, as you probably know, ran Spain for the southern Spain for 700 years, right. You know, so there was a time in history where, you know, the capital of southern Spain would have been Baghdad. And so for me, when I find when I mix, you know, that guitar playing that I do with Arabic violins or Persian sounds and Persian cadences, there's a kind of a shared history there. There's a kind of shared roots thing that just they really sort of sit beautifully together. So that's always been a kind of fertile area for exploration. In terms of, you know, other forms of music, there is really nowhere that I'm not happy to go off and try. You know, like I had a crazy experience last year when I went and toured in China. And discovered that there's a part of China, you know, no matter where we were, these guys would show up from a different part of China that I'd never been to. And they said, you know, they have a music there that sounds a bit like flamenco. And so they themselves, like there are a lot of flamenco guitarists in China who kind of came to it because their own music was so close to that, which totally surprised me. I would have thought that, you know, musically that they're so far apart that there wouldn't be any kind of shared history there. But you know, that's the kind of magic of world music and all these roots that kind of swirl around the world. We don't even know always how they get there.
Right.
You know, like the influence of African rhythms in most forms of music, whether it's jazz or pop or all of the different Latin American music forms, and, you know, or the fact that even some of those forms went back to Spain with sailors in the 1800s and rumba flamenco was created, you know, that sound that sort of 100 years later is what the Gypsy Kings were doing. You know, that came from Africa, that's round trip through Cuba. It's always amazing to me how that all works.
So much of your music is instrumental. What kind of story or message are you trying to tell your audience just through the music?
You know, it's funny. I don't have, as you say, I don't have lyrics. It's instrumental music. I'm not really about sort of telling people stories or telling them, you know, something specific. But I do feel that at this time, you know, we live in a time when people are back to talking about, you know, building walls and all that business. You know, there was, when I was a kid, you know, in the 80s or whatever, people, they were tearing down the Berlin Wall. You know, that was where we were at that point. And I sort of feel like now with Brexit and all of this, we're back to kind of really focusing on the differences between us. And I always feel that music, when you're making global music, there have been so many times where I've been in some country where I couldn't speak the language at all.
Right.
And yet, you know, I've been introduced to musicians. I was in China one time and I was in a theater in Beijing and they said, could you play with these Tibetan musicians? And I said, sure, I'd love to. And so I met these musicians backstage and we realized we didn't have one word in common. We couldn't even say hello. And I thought, how are we going to do this? And we pulled out our instruments and we started playing and we discovered, in fact, we do have a language in common, which is music. Music is the universal language. It's a cliche, you hear it all the time, but in my life, it has been an actual fact, a reality that I've lived so many times that I do feel like, you know, if music can kind of cross cultural boundaries, if music, when you take music from different cultures and they mix it together and it sounds so beautiful, I sort of feel like maybe music has something it can teach us.
Now, I read somewhere that your music came into broader attention as background music as a cable channel guide. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, in my 20s, I was a composer. I did music for, you know, television and theater and dance. And yeah, basically, I had to say yes to everything to make a living at the beginning, you know, when you first get out of music school. And I had written some music that was bought by a TV station, and they didn't say what they were going to use it for. They, you know, there was a Baroque piece I'd written and a piano piece, and there was a guitar piece. And the guitar piece was me sort of playing actually the way I play now on the guitar. Everything else was other compositions I had done, but you know, that were parts of other genres and things. And every time that one guitar piece would get played on this television station, and I think they were using it, as you said, as background on the TV Guide channel or something. Yeah. Every time that piece would play, the switchboard would light up at the local cable network, and you know, some poor woman would be saying, you know, what do you want? And they'd be saying, I want to get that piece of music. What was that music? You know, and she'd say, I don't know. Let me pass you to our music consultant. You know, and they would sort of make, they'd end up getting passed to many different people. Eventually somebody would say, I don't know. We bought this piece of music from this guy, Jesse, because here's his number, you know? And all through the year, I just kept getting phone calls at home from people saying, I want to buy this piece of music. And I kept saying, listen, I'm just a composer. I don't actually make music for the public. I'm sorry. It's not something I'm set up to do. And, but by the end of that year, I had a lot of friends who kept saying, you should make an album of your own music, you know, of your guitar playing. Cause at that point I was more writing for the orchestra, for everything, you know? Yeah. And they said, no, you should do the music that you do personally. Cause there is something that's kind of deeper about that than the other music that you compose. Cause it's more you. And by the end of the year, I thought, okay, I'll do this, you know, cause if I don't do it now, maybe I'll never do it. And then I'll wonder what if, and I really was convinced nothing was going to happen. I made the first record, Tempest. And by the end of that year, I went and got, you know, I was going to get 500 of them manufactured. And then they say, you know, for pennies more, I get 1,000. I thought, oh God, what am I going to do? There's going to be 1,000 CDs in my basement for the rest of my life. And I remember loading them in the back of my car thinking, oh, this is just not a good idea. Anyway, miraculously, they were gone by the end of the week. You know, I got an interview on the radio up here in Canada, and they flew out the door, and immediately the record stores were saying, we need 2,000 more, 3,000 more. And around the same time, I was getting calls from a bunch of record companies in the States, and I signed with a record company out of Milwaukee, and they got me into the Catalina Jazz Festival that September. And all of this happened so fast. I remember, again, it was one of those things where I remember trying to talk them out of, you know, sending me to the Catalina Jazz Festival, because I said, no one's going to want to watch this live, you know. And we played at Catalina, and the place went crazy. You know, that there was like a little store, like a variety store, you know, that sold you know, t-shirts from Catalina Island and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Right. And they called on the Monday. So we played over the weekend. On the Monday, they called up this record label that I was signed to. And they said, we want to order 10,000 CDs. And the guy who took the call almost fell out of his chair. He's like, are you a chain? And they said, no, we're one store. And so they went, the guy went and got the president of the company, who came and personally took the call. And they were all in shock. And then by that Wednesday, the Billboard chart came out and my album had debuted at number 14. And it was just like this insane moment where one moment I was completely unknown to everybody, including my own family. and the next minute, I'm on the Billboard charts, and I realized, oh my God, my life is about to change forever. And you know, ever since, this has been what I do.
Well, Jesse, I think that's all the time we have for questions. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Guitarist Jesse Cook speaking with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis last month. He'll perform at 8 Friday night at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Tickets begin at $25. More at waltonartscenter.org.
Sometimes the universe sends you a sign. Because we all need a push sometimes. And if you've been waiting for a nudge to start paying closer attention to the upcoming election, here it is. Morning Edition from NPR News will get you up to speed and keeps you informed with the updates you need every weekday. Some things are too important to wait for. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Tomorrow morning from 5 to 9 on 91.3. This is Ozarks at Large in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. With me is Catherine Sherrill. She is our militant grammarian. Hello.
Hi, Kyle. Do you remember Vernon Jordan?
Member of the Clinton administration? Mm-hmm. An advisor?
He
wasn't a secretary. Uh-huh. He wasn't a cabinet.
He wasn't head. Official,
yeah.
No.
Yes.
In 1998, the TV...
Kind of a campaign. Was with him in the campaign.
And in transition,
yes.
Especially.
Yes.
In 1998, the TV news show 60 Minutes did a profile of Jordan, a friend and political advisor to Clinton, Bill Clinton, who served as part of Clinton's transition team in 1992-93. His biography contains many more juicy details, but I'll leave that alone for now.
Okay, all right.
I liked one thing that the 60 Minutes reporter said about Jordan. More from my love of words than its sentiment, he said, Jordan hasn't always done good, but he's done well.
I like that.
And honestly, he might have said the other way around, that he hadn't done well, but he's done good.
You just love the distinction between well and good.
Exactly,
yeah.
And it's going to introduce our discussion today. What are the different uses of words good and well, which are generally considered synonyms? So in my example, Jordan hasn't always done good, but he's done well. What do the words good and well mean?
Good means a sort of moralistic sort of thing. He has done right by others and benefited society. Mm-hmm. Well means whatever he did, he achieved a level of success.
Yeah. Well, whether it was monetary or not. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Done well is often means made a lot of money, but it doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. So good is a noun. Mm-hmm. It tells what you're doing. He has
right.
done good.
Although, just like he has done evil.
Right.
Good or evil,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think if people don't feel comfortable with that construction, you could think he has done good things.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
you can make it an adjective. But it is a noun. And well is an adverb.
Mm. Hmm.
It tells how you're doing it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So if you're building houses with Habitat for Humanity, you're doing what?
Well, you're doing good.
Right.
And hopefully you're doing it well, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if somebody asked you how the house construction is coming along, you'd say...
It's going well.
Yeah. But, of course, this is English, so the story doesn't end there.
Right.
Both good and well can also be adjectives. When you're all dressed up, you look...
Swell? Oh, wait. You look good. You look good.
You do.
Right. Sorry.
You may look swell.
Forgot what we
but
were even talking about, apparently.
What year were you born
well,
again?
Yeah, right.
But when you're getting over the flu, you start to feel...
Well.
Yes. In these constructions, good and well are both predicate adjectives. Mm-hmm. Adjectives following linking verbs like look and feel.
And I can think of another way that well is an adjective.
What?
I grew up drinking well water.
Sure, I was thinking of that when I thought of that.
But that's not
earlier.
The same thing.
But look and feel can also be action verbs. They look for pretty leaves. So they're doing something mm-hmm. rather mm-hmm. than the way they look, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
They're actually doing something.
Right.
It's an intransitive action verb. You should feel the door to see if it is hot. So feel there really means using your hands.
Right.
It's not how... Your body is
your
reacting.
Temperament,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right. So good and well muddy the water, but not nearly as much as bad and badly.
Cool.
If the flu hits you, Kyle, mm-hmm. I keep you know. I hope the flu. I hope you've had your shot.
Yes.
If the flu hits you and someone inquires about your health, you would say, "I feel bad" or "I feel badly."
I feel bad.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of people use badly, thinking
yeah.
that
yeah.
bad just doesn't sound grammatical.
Right.
But if you're going to feel badly, what does that mean?
Well, if I'm supposed to feel like the carpet sample and I just kind of plop my hand
yeah.
down or something, I mean, I'm doing it poorly.
Or
right?
you've got on oven mitts.
Right, right,
right.
Yeah. I am not doing a very good job
yes.
of feeling.
Of touching things.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yes, of touching things.
Okay. But if you're under the weather, you feel mm-hmm. bad. Also, you would feel bad for someone who lost a job.
Yes.
I feel
yes.
bad for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
The rule is with the four senses, look, smell, taste, and feel, figure out if these words are being used actively, whether you're feeling something or it's the way
okay.
your body
okay.
reacts. To decide whether to follow them with good or well. Okay, Kyle, what's the difference in these two sentences? You smell good today. You smell well for someone with a cold.
You smell good. Whatever perfume or cologne you have on, I like.
Mm-hmm.
You smell well for someone with a cold. Usually with a cold, your nose doesn't work, mm-hmm. but you could smell the bacon.
Right. Perfect.
This reminds me
yes.
Of an old Monty Python skit.
Oh, let's hear it.
Where there was... I don't remember the entire premise. This is decades ago I saw. But the idea was that somebody had invented a joke so hilarious that people would die laughing and they would use it for execution. And the joke was, my dog has no nose. Well, how does it smell?
horrible. Yeah.
I don't think I'll die, but that's good.
Exactly. The whole buildup was how poor, how bad a joke it was. Yeah. But go ahead. I digress.
Okay. Another rule is when referring to health, always use well.
Okay.
By the way, the word here... H-E-A-R, which is another sense, of course,
right.
is always used actively. She hears good or she heals. Which is it? She hears good or she hears well?
She hears well.
Yeah.
Because it's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another rule. When describing someone's emotional state, use good. He doesn't feel good about having cheated.
Okay.
Not he doesn't feel well.
Oh, right, 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 right.
But if we're back to, well, if we're back to health, he doesn't feel well today.
Right. Now, let me ask you about this. Okay, so his guilt about cheating has made him feel such that he's sick to his stomach. Would you then say he doesn't feel well because he cheated?
Don't mess with my hypothetical.
I suppose you would say it's not because he cheated that he feels sick to his stomach. It's because of stress or something. I'm really picking nits here.
I think your hypothetical is okay. And it reminds me of I moved from a so-so school district to a really bad school district in Arkansas when I was a junior. And my English class, my English teacher loved me because I would always come up with things like that. You know, she would state rules and I'd say, well, what about blah, 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 blah.
And she liked that.
Yeah, yeah, especially in diagramming sentences. Oh, yeah. I would say, well, what if, you know.
And now, at the risk of going down one more tangent, do people still diagram sentences? Is that still something that happens?
I made students do that in my grammar classes. Okay. But, there are some of us who hang on to it lovingly. Diagramming, to truly understand grammar, which, let me just pull this out of the air, 20% of people do, you have to diagram.
Right.
But the whole thing about, well, you know what I meant, is just so prevalent.
Yeah.
And quite often you don't know what they meant.
All right, I've done a good job of getting us off topic, so let's go back. Okay.
All right. Kyle, if someone asks you, how are you, you would answer with either good or well.
Mm-hmm.
What would determine which you would use?
Well, and I meant that unironically. If I think that my life is in accordance to where I want it to be, I think I'd say I'm doing well, because that means it's successful.
Okay, let me back up to the rule.
Okay.
When describing someone's emotional state, use good.
So if you ask me the question again.
How are you?
I'm good. That's,
What does that mean? Is that, the question is that physical or is that emotional?
Well, right. And I think generally, now if you're asking me after I've broken my leg or something like that, but I think generally we're asking someone like, where are you in the state of affairs of your life?
And that would be?
Good.
Yeah.
The well sounds so much more grammatically right, doesn't it? No? Okay. All right.
I feel good.
Yeah, good point.
But, and it goes back to your messing with my hypothetical. You used good, and then you said it made him sick to his stomach, so he didn't feel well.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Yeah.
But generally, I think people are asking about your state of affairs.
Yeah, they're asking mostly about emotions.
Generally, right.
Yeah, yeah. So,
how you doing?
So good.
Yeah. How's the holiday season going for you?
It's going good.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
All right, quiz time.
No.
She danced very well or very good for her age?
She danced very well for her age.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We had a good or a well time at the lake?
Well, yeah,
no,
a good time.
That's wrong.
Yeah, a good time.
With a high fever, it is unlikely he will feel good or well enough for his walk.
Well enough.
Mm-hmm. That dress looks good or well on you?
It looks good on you.
Well, it was good talking with you, Kyle.
our Milton Grammarian is Catherine Sherrills.
Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Prairie Grove.
91.3, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this Tuesday show included Susanna Sitek and Timothy Dennis. Timothy also mastered our show in the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio. Our conversations between John Brummett and Roby Brock are recorded at the studios of KATV in Little Rock and part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Our militant grammarian is Catherine Schultz. We're back tomorrow at noon and 7 with another edition of Ozarks at Large. More news and information from the region tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30 with Antoinette Grajeda's newscast, Inside Morning Edition. You can also find past stories, interviews, and editions of Ozarks at Large at ozarksatlarge.com. Talk to you tomorrow.